From the studios of WHQR Public Radio in Wilmington, this is Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Our topic today is safe communities versus citizens' rights. It was the shooting of an unarmed Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, that launched a nationwide debate over police tactics. Brown, who is African-American, was killed August 9th by a white Ferguson police officer. Just weeks earlier, an unarmed Eric Garner died on Staten Island after being put in a chokehold by police for allegedly selling cigarettes illegally. But questions around the use of force by police had already been marinating in the Cape Fear region. The shooting of three suspects by officers last fall following the robbery of a Wilmington Pizza Hut, the shooting of a woman earlier this year who was reportedly suicidal, and the shooting and killing of Brandon Smith also last October after a car chase and a foot pursuit launched local protests and public outcry. At the August 19th Wilmington City Council meeting, Councilmember Earl Sheridan asked the city manager, in conjunction with the police department, to answer questions about community relations training for police, the kinds of tactical weapons that the department has, along with policies on their use, whether police wear cameras on their uniforms, and the degree of diversity on the police force. Chief Ralph Evangelist was scheduled to appear before council last night with a report, but a family emergency has taken him out of town, and of course, we wish the chief and his family the best. Joining us today to speak for the Wilmington Police Department is Deputy Chief Mitch Cunningham. Deputy Chief Cunningham, welcome to Coastline.
Good afternoon.
Also with us in the studio today, she's president of the New Hanover County chapter of the NAACP, Deborah Dix Maxwell. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
During the next hour, you're invited to join our discussion. Do you think local police are guilty of using excessive force? Are they doing their best in tough circumstances? Do you have a question for Deputy Chief Cunningham or Deborah Dix Maxwell? Give us a call at 910-343-1138. You can send an email to coastline@whqr.org. You can also tweet us using coastlinehqr. Deborah Dix Maxwell, the local NAACP has been a vocal critic of recent police tactics. What's the problem from your point of view?
As you mentioned the word excessive force, unfortunately, we realize we've already had grand jury decisions that have said it wasn't, but the community itself feels that it is. It's deterred the efforts of community policing and trust within the community.
Deputy Chief Cunningham, why do you think this concern, this vocal protest over local police tactics, has crescendoed so sharply within the last year? Do we have a problem?
I think our problem is we have to bridge the gap of trust in our community and spend time showing the types of policing we do and bring the community closer together in our decision-making, in transparency into all the things we do so that they can see that this is a police department that is focused on meeting the needs of the community.
So you're saying if there was greater transparency, then that would be one way to bridge this trust gap?
Meaning that we just need to do more. We have to look for every opportunity we can, and we've been doing a lot recently, but we need to look for every opportunity we can to tell our story and talk to people about our professionalism and about the things we're doing on behalf of the community.
Deputy Chief Cunningham, can you describe from an officer's point of view what it's like when an officer gets a call for a potentially incendiary situation, a tense situation or potentially deadly perhaps? What happens? What goes through his head? How does he approach the situation? What is that like for those of us who've never been in a circumstance like that before?
Sure. Well, it's important to note, of course, that goes on every night and sometimes during the day. Our officers are engaged in urban policing. This is a busy city. And every night or during the daytime, they're faced with an unknown situation. Immediately, they call upon their training. They try to gather as much information as they have, as they can prior to arriving on the scene. They may take some preemptive steps to tactically prepare themselves, which means they may not go immediately to the scene. They may ask that another officer meets them at a certain staging point, and then together they will approach the scene. But every scene potentially can be explosive, and we know that there's a lot of weapons on the street. We've done some recent studies, and we know that, for example, we're basically taking a gun off the street every day in Wilmington.
Can you think of a circumstance that you've been in as a police officer? And you said that you've been here a couple of years, but you worked for many years in Maryland. Can you just describe a circumstance without naming names or anything that would identify that circumstance in which you received a call like that, and just take us through it?
Well, after 30 years, there's been quite a few. If you're talking from a patrol perspective, and in many situations, patrol is at the greatest risk because everybody knows who they are. They're coming in a big car. They're wearing a uniform. And at that moment, patrol has the least amount of information. By the time the detectives get on scene, or if we're doing other types of operations, the people arriving will have had a pretty involved threat picture, a pretty involved set of information that they can call upon. But patrol doesn't get that luxury. And so, you know, I can think of times where arriving on the scene of perhaps a domestic situation, and as you're arriving, you're of course getting snippets of information. Perhaps the person has a weapon. You're not sure who else you will be facing once you come through that door. You're not sure if in one moment the victim may find you at this point to become the aggressor, and they may have decided not to want police involvement, and at that point you potentially have two threats. So the situations are particularly volatile, and they can change very rapidly.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking about recent tensions between local law enforcement and members of the community and how some of those tensions might be eased or bridged. The number to call if you have a question for Deborah Dix Maxwell from the NAACP is 910-343-1138, or for Deputy Chief Mitch Cunningham from the Wilmington Police Department. Earl, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Hello?
Hello. You're on the air.
Yes, ma'am. I guess my question is for the police deputy chief. And it seems like the police officers, I'm quite sure they go to the range and they practice shots, and they should be proficient with their weapon. Why does it seem like all the time that with most fatal children or black people is always headshots and not, you know, like the lower part of the body, the legs or something?
So you're talking about firing a shot in a tense situation that perhaps would not be a fatal shot.
Right.
Well,
Deputy Chief.
Sure. The way police officers are taught to use deadly force is to aim for what's known as center mass, because we know from research that that's the easiest target to make. And if you've decided, based on your perception of the situation that you're faced with, that this now calls for deadly force, the biggest decision an officer can make in his or her career, if you are in that situation at that moment, we're taught that you want to hit center mass because it's more likely to stop the aggression, the force that you're facing.
But is there a time when an officer would choose to fire and not use deadly force, or every time an officer fires, he has made the decision that he's using deadly force, or she?
Sure, and he or she is using force to stop. You know, it is deadly by definition, but they're trying to stop the threat. One of the misperceptions that some folks have about perhaps that police could use, you know, shots in the leg or the arm, they are so difficult to hit in a highly stressful situation. And while we train our officers annually and make opportunities available for them to augment their training throughout the year, in that highly stressful situation, center mass is the most logical place for them to hit, because it'll stop the threat and end up where they're aiming.
Earl, thanks so much for your call. You're listening to Coastline. We're talking about the balance between safe communities and citizens' rights. If you have a question, give us a call at 910-343-1138. Deborah Dix Maxwell, do you believe that an officer's view of other races or racial profiling affects the outcome of some of these highly charged situations?
Unfortunately, it appears to be true. We don't have a large number of diverse staff, which Ferguson implicated, and if you look at other cities, you'll see that ratio.
You're saying we don't have a large number of diverse people of different races on the police force.
The numbers may be close to the population here, but overall, there needs to be an improvement. If the city of Wilmington is strictly, mainly a lot of people of color, then the force should be reflective of that or understanding of the cultural differences and diversity in just approaching an officer. And to that effect, I'm ordering these forms that is called the 411 on the 50 through the National NAACP Legal Department to distribute to the community and hopefully have a meeting after we receive those.
When we come, can you tell me briefly what's in that brochure that you're holding up, the 411 on the 50?
The NAACP Real World Guide to Interacting with Law Enforcement. So it tells you do's and don'ts of your approach, how to respond in your home, in your car, or on the street, and what to do if you are arrested.
And I think we'll want to hear more about that when we come back from the break. You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. We're talking about tensions between law enforcement and community members, especially in light of the Ferguson, Missouri shooting and subsequent local protests. If you have a question for the NAACP's Deborah Dix Maxwell or Deputy Chief of the Wilmington Police, Mitch Cunningham, give us a call, 910-343-1138. You can also send emails to coastline at whqr.org or tweet us at coastlinehqr. This is Coastline. Welcome back to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. With me in the studio, once again, Deputy Police Chief Mitch Cunningham and New Hanover County NAACP President Deborah Dix Maxwell. We're talking about police tactics in light of the Ferguson, Missouri shooting and local protests over the use of force. If you have a question for the NAACP's Deborah Dix Maxwell or Deputy Police Chief Mitch Cunningham, we'd like to hear from you. Give us a call at 910-343-1138 or send an email to coastline at whqr.org. You can also tweet us using coastlinehqr. And right before we went to the break, Deborah Dix Maxwell, you were showing me a brochure that says the 411 on the 50, which is basically how to deal with the police under certain circumstances. Before you tell me about some of those circumstances, Deputy Chief Cunningham, what does that make you think that they actually have to put out a brochure to get through an encounter with officers?
Well, before I get to that, I just wanted to clear up a matter that was raised. Ms. Maxwell talked about the diversity in our department. We're approximately 16% African-American, and I think it's close to 20% African-American in the city. So I just wanted to show that there's a gap to be filled, but we're working hard with our training and recruiting to fill that. You know, the first thought I had when Deborah showed it said brochure is, ironically enough, the police department runs a similar program. Of course, I haven't read the brochure, so I'm not sure what it says. But our program is called Police 101, and we have been using that in our public housing partnerships. And so our officers are talking about, you know, myths about police work, and talking about some of the information that needs to be presented in public housing. And it's a really good partnership, and I think people are positively responding for it. Responding to it. So I'm interested to see how closely it mirrors this brochure.
Deborah Dix Maxwell, what are some of the pointers in that brochure? The 411 on the 50.
In your car, one, upon request, present your driver's license, registration, and proof of insurance. If you are suspected of drunk driving and refuse to take a sobriety test, the police may seize your driver's license. Three, if the police state they have probable cause, they may begin to search your car without your consent. Do not interfere, but clearly state your lack of consent. Five, if you are given a ticket, sign it. You can always fight the case in court later. And that's what to do in your car. Just simple tips to help people. Unfortunately, during this time in this country, we used to have a saying, DWB, driving while black, for our young brothers who, like my cousin, a doctor, who drives a luxury car, will be stopped. Unfortunately, in the light of Ferguson and other incidents around this country, for our brothers as LWB, we're concerned about them just living while black in this country.
You know, President Obama raised that same issue, talking about what it might be like if he had a son. And the fact, is this common, Deborah Dix Maxwell, that if you have a son and you're African American, you are going to have to teach that child how to navigate this country and law enforcement to stay alive?
At this time, it appears to be. You look at the statistics nationwide. It is not just a Wilmington problem. It is a national problem.
Deputy Chief Mitch Cunningham, there are some stereotypes that you referred to about officers. And, you know, there's the ever popular stereotype about someone goes into law enforcement because they're a control freak or they have a thing about needing to exert authority. That's pretty widespread. Is that true? And are there people on the force that shouldn't be because they have psychological issues like that?
Well, I will tell you that to become a police officer, it's a very involved process. Obviously, there's psychological tests, polygraphs, background checks. So it's pretty involved. Now, that's not to say that there aren't folks that get onto the police department and then through their performance, we'll weed them out. But there's, you know, certainly there's misperceptions about police officers and their motivation for wanting to join our profession. I will tell you, in my experience, what I've been so impressed with is the quality of folks that we get. As you can well imagine, after 9/11, I think most police agencies saw a spike of applications, people wanting to serve their country. If they couldn't do it overseas, they were going to do it here in their own communities. And we're very proud and feel a deep sense of responsibility to prepare those folks for a long career and get them raise their level of professionalism. And that's Chief Evangelist is always very intent on making sure that folks have got training and is looking forward. What do we need next? What should we be doing? What are we learning about today that we need to be preparing for tomorrow?
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking about the balance between safe communities and citizens' rights. If you have a question for Deborah Dix Maxwell from the NAACP or Deputy Chief Mitch Cunningham from the Wilmington Police Department, give us a call at 910-343-1138. You can also send an email to coastline@whqr.org. And Amy from Hampstead, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air. Amy? And Amy is gone. We have John from Jacksonville. Welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Yes. I have a question for the Deputy Chief. Deputy Chief, I've seen instances where people were threatened by lions or tiger, or even I've seen a bear up a tree, and they use tranquilizing guns and that type of thing so they don't kill the animals. Why can't they do such a thing with humans?
Deputy Chief?
Sure. In the last 15, 20 years in our profession, there has been a very concerted effort to bring in what we call less than lethal force. So the electronic control measures that we have, which commonly known as tasers, is one example. OC spray is another example. More and more and better defensive tactics. We're improving all the time. We have organizations in our profession, PERF, IACP, and others, who continually look at ways to increase our ability to place people into custody without ever having to go to lethal force. That's always our last option, unfortunately.
John, thanks so much for your call. Earl from Wilmington actually called back, and he wanted to know why police don't stay within city limits. Is that an issue?
Are you talking about City of Wilmington police officers leaving?
I imagine that's what he's city limits? Asking, but he's not on the line. Yes. Do you know what he might be referring to?
I guess the way I would answer that question is, of course, we have police officers from the city who are working on city-county task forces. So it's possible that you could see perhaps a city officer outside of city limits working perhaps in narcotics gangs, and vice versa. We have a significant amount of sheriff's deputies who are part of our task forces working inside the city.
Deborah Dix Maxwell from the NAACP, you've said before that there are incidents involving officers that go unreported, racial profiling incidents that go unreported. Complaints aren't filed because people are fearful of retribution. And you told a story about a teenage boy, taking his family's household trash to the curb, putting it out, and being detained while he was taking out the trash. Can you tell us about that and what your concern is along those lines?
My concern was it was getting dusk. He was taking the trash out of his yard to the curb like any teenager should do. A lot of them don't. And he was detained by his yard. It was maybe a month after or two after Smith, but that was unnecessary because it wasn't that part of town. He wasn't doing anything. His mother did not know what had happened. And he was fearful of telling her till much later. And this is where the trust evolves. This is a large family, so I'm sure that family told other families about this incident. But no, they did not wish to pursue this. And we have numerous calls from people who choose not to pursue because they are in fear of their economic livelihood or the fact that they have to live within the city limits and they will be scrutinized by patrols.
So you're saying, Deborah Dix Maxwell, just to be clear, that this wasn't an isolated incident, this wasn't an anomaly, this is something that happens frequently?
It's frequent enough. One time is too many in this era. We had an incident where someone's car was listed as being armed and dangerous on TV, and it could not be retracted until the police station retracted it. I'm thankful to our Father Almighty that nothing happened to that individual because they parked the car. But these are dangerous times. What if someone else had not known that in law enforcement?
Deputy Chief Maxwell. Sure. Mitch Cunningham.
Well, what I would ask is, for people, if they do feel that our officers have taken measures that are unfair or don't make sense to them at that time, is to give us a call. What does happen, in fact, is, and of course I don't know about the individual situation, but just in general, sometimes it's, very often it's helpful for a person like this to contact a supervisor after the matter has concluded and then have the supervisor maybe explain what the officer was doing at that particular moment. In some cases, what we've even done is read information from CAD notes. In other words, every call, of course, is logged into our CAD system. And once a person learns why the officer responded in the way they have, often it's because of what the original complainant told them to expect when they got there. Now, of course, I'm not saying that that's what occurred in this situation, but it's surprising how helpful it can be after the incident is concluded for people to talk to each other and explain and maybe take apart some perceptions each one had.
We encourage that. That's the first thing we tell people. You need to go to the station and file a complaint, and they go, "Oh, no, I can't do that." And we have a legal redress form if we are to assist them, which they must complete. And they say, "Oh, no, I'm fearful of that." So that is our first recourse. We want them to talk with whoever's involved because otherwise that person won't know.
Right. And we do, too.
Deputy Chief Cunningham, can you understand why someone might be fearful about filing a complaint and might be fearful about a greater scrutiny or retribution from the force?
Absolutely, and that's part of that trust and that gap that programs like this is going to give us an opportunity to hopefully overcome. You know, I was talking to one of our lieutenants who oversees a public housing, and we were talking about what had been like in 2013 when there was such a spike of violence, and we were trying to put in measures into place and working with the community on problem solving. And she was telling me a story about an officer just walking through, I believe it was Creekwood, and a woman invited him in to share a birthday cake with her family and her son. And to us, that typified some real progress there. And that's the direction we're going to continue to head in.
Davana from Rocky Point wants to know if she heard correctly that Wilmington is now majority-minority. And if so, why aren't there more minority police officers? I think the first part of that, no, that's not correct.
Correct.
we are majority white at this point.
Correct.
Is that? But you said the population is about 20% African American, and we have about 16% of the police force is African American.
That is correct.
What are some of the things that an African American officer would understand from experience, from upbringing, that a white officer needs to be educated about?
Each culture has its own specific traits and mannerisms or things that occur. For us, it may be talking on the corner. If I'm standing at the corner of Ms. Ruth's store, your officer may just drive by and think they're doing a drug deal. That's where I grew up. I might be talking with someone I hadn't seen in a while. You could go drive by 30 minutes later and I'd still be there, so I really look like I'm doing something. And it's just that's a summertime pastime, standing on the corner, sitting on the porch. There are just certain culturally specific things that we have to be aware of each group and diversity. One thing that showed a great model of community policing, there's a viral YouTube video showing a police officer trying to do a dance contest with some kids in the Midwest. He didn't win, but it just showed that he put forth the effort.
Hey, he was trying, right?
Yes.
Have you seen this video, Debbie?
I have not.
We'll have to post this on our website if we can find it. That's great. You're listening to Coastline. We're talking about the balance between safe communities and citizens' rights. If you have a question for Deputy Chief Mitch Cunningham or the NAACP's Deborah Dix Maxwell, give us a call at 910-343-1138. Peter from Wilmington, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Yes, ma'am. I have a question for Ms. Maxwell, and this is just a perception. Maybe I'm wrong, but the standards for the application of deadly force are that you are in fear of death or grievous bodily injury to yourself or a third party. And it seems to me, and I got this impression from the two callers also, the two previous callers, it seems to me that there's a prevailing attitude that law enforcement officers don't have that right, that they're held to some higher standard, and that when they're confronted with an armed suspect, they're supposed to beg, plead, and cajole that person into surrendering rather than using deadly force. And I just, I'm at a loss to understand that mindset, and I'll take the answer off the air. Thank you.
Thanks so much for your call, Pete. Deborah Dix Maxwell. Let me ask you this. Were you about to respond?
No,
because
go ahead.
I have a question about the Pizza Hut shooting that happened in Wilmington in October of last year. There were three suspects. There was a robbery going on. As I understand it, police watched through the window and saw suspects with what they thought were weapons, guns. And when the suspects came running out, two of them ran towards officers with weapons in their hands. And so, you know, not having been there, and there's so much about this that I don't know, and I recognize that, but this was the subject of some of the protests. And had I been in that circumstance, I don't know, I have no police training, but I imagine I would feel that my life was at risk. Should the officers not have fired in that circumstance?
I have not seen the video, and until I see that, I can only speculate about what occurred. I've been to the site. I've seen where the shots were all the way across the street. So
all the way across the street?
There was a store across the street in which had holes in their window, because it was Wellington, that Pizza Hut. If you look, that was a major intersection by a major business. From what I understand, there was undercover subterfuge within the bushes coming out, approaching young men who were athletic and running. I'm not defending them. I'm not defending the police. But until I see the footage.
But you're saying there are legitimate questions surrounding the officer shooting of those young men?
Yes. Well, but we also at that time asked for the city of Wilmington, along with New Hanover County, while we are on air, to create a citizens review board. And here we are in the ninth month of this year, and there has been no mention, with the exception of a comment made by City Councilman Earl Sheridan, about the implementation of this within this city, which would alleviate a lot of this. A grand jury is not made up of only registered voters, which we're trying to increase the African-American pool so that they will have the opportunity to become jurists. But until we reach that point.
So in a circumstance like this, if we'd had a citizens review board put together, then this would have come before that board.
And it would have quelled a lot of the issues and the rumblings that occurred, because that board could have come back and said, look, people, this is it. Because it would have been comprised of a diaspora of this community. It wouldn't be just black. It wouldn't be just white. It wouldn't be just upper class or middle class, because there were a lot of people who have been involved in review boards across the country who live in this city who want to participate.
Well, I just wanted to make a point about the Pizza Hut. Obviously, it was investigated by the FBI. Obviously, all the evidence was presented before the grand jury, and the officers were cleared. This was a series of seven robberies that had occurred, and in at least one of the robberies, one of the victims was badly beaten. So the officers that were approaching the scene were aware of these circumstances as they were dealing with that situation. So I hear some music, so I think I'll curtail my remarks.
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. We're talking about tensions between law enforcement and community members, especially in light of the Ferguson, Missouri shooting. Give us a call at 910-343-1138. We actually have a full bank of callers lit up, and we will take those calls when we come back from the break. You can also send an email to coastline@whqr.org. You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. Welcome back to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Once again, joining us in the studio, Deputy Police Chief Mitch Cunningham and New Hanover County NAACP President Deborah Dix Maxwell. We're talking about police tactics and community relations and the tensions between certain members of the community and law enforcement, how law enforcement is responding. If you have a question for either of our guests, give us a call at 910-343-1138. You can send an email if you can't get through to coastline@whqr.org. Caleb from Wilmington, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Thank you very much. There are lots of things at play here. It's good we're having a discussion about tactics and procedure and whatnot. But the large man that died of asphyxiation, I assume, in New York City.
That was selling, Eric Garner, I believe, yes.
Yeah, selling Lucy's. He was, you know, the conflict ensued. He was approached because he was violating tax law, I believe, selling single cigarettes. I believe the issue was tax law. Other people are killed in the course of enforcing drug laws. A flash grenade landed on a baby's head a few months ago in another state. We can reform all we want as far as procedure and that sort of thing. We can demilitarize the police if we like. But isn't the fundamental problem, I'd like to know Ms. Maxwell's thoughts on this, onerous regulation on individuals? Aren't these conflicts ensuing because of the labyrinthine and, you know, ridiculous explosion of regulation on individuals, their behavior, what they can consume, and the rejection of the idea that the individual is their own property?
So you're asking a question about individual freedoms and liberty, and did that lead to the death of Eric Garner in Staten Island?
Yeah, I mean, how much can we really trust a law enforcement and judicial system that holds the fundamental view that the individual is not their own property? That their bodily actions that harm no one else are under the jurisdiction of society or the state.
Caleb,
that we are not our own property, which seems to me a fundamental American idea.
Thanks so much for your call, Caleb. Deborah Dix Maxwell.
We are responsible for our own bodies and ourselves, but as individuals in this country called America, which I'm proud to be a veteran, we are privileged to have a set of rules, laws, regulations, amendments in the Constitution that we must follow, and we do go to a jury or a grand jury for our recourse. I lived 2 years under martial law, so I suggest if you have not done something like that or been in a war-torn area, we need to also be thankful for what we have and what we do.
You're listening.
Thank you for your service, by the way.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking about the balance between safe communities and citizens' rights. Jim from Carolina Beach, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Yes, I'd like to address this question to the gentleman representing the police department. Why, with the powerful weapons you have, I don't know whether it's a Glock or whatnot, do you feel it's necessary, or an officer, to fire so many rounds into an individual? I mean, has anybody that's ever been shot or seen the response of what a bullet can do, especially from a powerful weapon, know that one or two will get that person's attention and slow them and knock them down? Why fire 10, 20, 30 rounds? It's like you're butchering a cow or a chicken or something, an animal, a hog. That's butchering, isn't it?
Deputy Chief Mitch Cunningham.
Well, I think there's been some incidents around the country where it's been clear that the police have used too many, they've fired too many times. But the way police are taught is to shoot until the threat stops. So, and if you've got a person running towards you or wielding a weapon of some sort, and they continue to move to you, then you're taught and expected to use your deadly force, if that's appropriate, that situation, until that threat stops. And that may be one or two bullets, or it could be in excess of that, depending on the reaction to the force you're using.
And of course, what comes to mind is the case of Brandon Smith, who was also shot and killed in October of last year by local law enforcement. And he was shot 27 times. And it's, you know, for people, once again, as Deborah Dix Maxwell has said, people who weren't there and didn't see the circumstance. It is hard, though, to understand why officers needed to fire 27 times on Brandon Smith.
Sure. Not being there at the scene, it's understandable that that sounds like a lot. You've got different officers there, multiple officers there, and if one or two several are firing, then and each one is firing three or four shots, then that's going to explain the number of bullets that were fired.
Jim, thanks so much for your call. We have Stacy from Wilmington. Welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Yes, I got a question for the deputy.
Deputy Chief, yes.
Uh-huh. When he had made the comment earlier that when you have a problem that you should call into the police department and everything, and that it will explain why it was handled that way or whatever, mm-hmm. How can you explain why something was handled if you wasn't there and the only thing that you have is the word of your officer? It, to us in this black community, we feel as if it's a cover-up.
Deputy Chief.
Well, I'm sorry you feel that way. What I would say is, you know, currently we have in-car video, and our internal affairs checks in-car video on every use of force. We have, of course, witnesses. Witnesses will call in who may not have been personally affected, but to let us know about something that they feel has taken place that may be an accusation against our officer. You know, we'll have other officers present. So there's a lot of ways to bring what people may feel is misconduct to our attention, and we investigate every one of them.
If these instances were investigated, would it be possible that there would be more trust between law enforcement and the community? I mean, are there instances, like Deborah Dix Maxwell, you raised the question about the teenager who was taking out his family's household garbage and was detained. But is it possible that there are incidents that happen and people felt like they were burned for bringing it before law enforcement? How did this develop, I guess, is what I'm asking, this mistrust?
Well, I think in some cases that people are not giving the system an opportunity to work, and I think that's part of the efforts that we've got to just redouble to tell people that we want to hear from them, and I would say we also want to hear from them when the officer does something right too. Obviously, I mean, we've got a lot of great police work going on out there, and people are just putting themselves at great risk on behalf of this community. It makes us proud every day. But if they're seeing something that they believe is incorrect, please let us know. Give us a chance to deal with that, and let the system work.
And we did get an anonymous caller who asks, are anonymous tips really anonymous?
Yes, we have a system called Text-A-Tip, and in fact, it's very much anonymous, and we've used it very effectively to get information, and in many cases for narcotics cases or for other acts of a serious crime, that's been very helpful. And we would encourage people to call Text-A-Tip and or text a Text-A-Tip, but give us information, and we will use that on behalf of the community.
And that is absolutely anonymous.
Correct. Absolutely.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking about the balance between safe communities and citizens' rights. Do you have a question for Deputy Chief Mitch Cunningham or the NAACP's president, Deborah Dix Maxwell? If so, give us a call, 910-343-1138. I want to address this report that Chief Evangelist had planned to deliver to City Council last night. Earl Sheridan, a member of City Council, had raised concerns in light of the Ferguson, Missouri shootings. And he'd asked for some very specific information, community relations training, what are we doing about that? How are officers trained for diffusing tense or deadly situations? What are the tactical weapons used by the department and the policies around their use? Can you, Deputy Chief Mitch Cunningham, just share with us some of the points that Chief Evangelist was going to raise at last night's meeting before he was called away for a family emergency.
Sure, and it's important to note he will be making that presentation in the near future, so he will have lots of details and be able to present that information. In general, before that meeting takes place, one concern has been the militarization of the police. And I'll just, share with you an anecdote that I experienced personally. Years ago, I was a hostage negotiator. And so prior to us receiving an armored vehicle, what you would literally do is if you were trying to make contact with a subject who refused to make contact, you and your partner would have to, low crawl, would have to be very carefully get as close as you could with a bullhorn to engage the person. You wanted to get them talking. You wanted to gather information. Later, when we had an armored vehicle, I was able to, and my partner was able to be transported to that area, and from a very safe position, we could talk with that person. So when Americans see these scary vehicles, I think we all feel that way. I mean, why are they here? I mean, what are they doing driving up our street? But I think if you understand, at least in some cases, the reasoning behind the additional protection, some of these, yes, they were military tools prior to us receiving them, but they have innate capabilities that make our folks safer, and we want our folks to be able to take advantage of some of them. Having said that, I think the chief will allay a lot of fears when he talks about specifically what we're using. I think most people will agree that it's very understandable.
We have an email from Jessica. She says, where did the funding for the helicopters come from? What concrete benefits has their use brought to our community? Many feel that they are a nuisance and overkill.
Well, sure. Actually, the helicopters are one of the entities that we've received from the federal government. The helicopter is really a great tool, and I know for some folks, they hear it up there, they're not really sure what it's being used for. It may feel a little, annoying or burdensome, but it's important to note that helicopter has been used to rescue people. It's been used to provide additional support in a pursuit situation. They light up areas when we need a safer working environment, depending on what incident we're facing with, being faced with. They're used for a lot of tasks. It's not a nice-to-have type of tool. It's something we've needed, and we're really pleased that we're able to have them.
Are uniform cameras that are actually part of a police officer's uniform, something that the Wilmington Police Department uses?
Yes, we have approximately 40 of these cameras. We've been testing them, learning how to use them, learning which devices work best. As you probably know, they come in a lot of different varieties. They either attach to the body, or there's actually devices that will go on glasses, on hats that you can wear. So we're in a testing phase, but we foresee wider spread use than what we have right now.
Deborah Dix Maxwell of the NAACP, are there steps that members of the community can take to start bridging the gap between law enforcement and community members?
Yes, there are.
What
are
some things?
I've spoken to the chief and the sheriff, and we'll invite them before the year is out to our NAACP monthly meeting so that they can meet members of the community. We meet every fourth Thursday at St. Stephen at 5th and Red Cross at 7, and they both responded, yes, that I just need to get back with them.
And we were talking earlier about some other mechanisms that have been in place in the past, I believe. Sonia Patrick of the local Black Leadership Caucus has talked about the Citizens Review Board. She's talked about a Human Relations Board. Deborah Dix Maxwell, what's the difference between those two ideas? And is that something that we should consider instituting?
I'm hoping that we will consider the institution. Human Relations Commission was dissolved by New Hanover County a few years ago out of budgetary measures. Because of that, I receive an inordinate amount of people's complaints that it is hard for us as a volunteer organization to handle. So there are still needs prior to EEOC. Some are valid and some are invalid because we can only work with them when it's a case of racial discrimination. But a Human Relations Commission could help them with all the other issues that people really have and direct them. We still direct them, but it's very time consuming.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking about the balance between safe communities and citizens' rights. Ski from Castlehaine, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Hello, how are you?
Good, thanks. How are you?
Oh, just honky-dory. I wanted to make a quick comment. I'm a business owner in the Wilmington or New Hanover County area. I was born and raised in Detroit and had a chance to be a police officer there. And then being in the military, you get to see a lot of global action. One thing that really frustrates me about how people are reacting to police officers getting military vehicles, one thing that I feel a lot of people are blind about is the one action that took place in L.A. about 20 years ago when two individuals robbed a Bank of America, and many police officers got slain due to the fact that they didn't have the equipment to uphold the AK-47. I am a person that believes in gun rights, but I am a person also that doesn't believe that a person on the street shouldn't have an AK-47. There should be certain things the military should have, and then there's certain things that the policeman should have, but those things should be also excluded from the public. I know we have rights as citizens, but we have rights as citizens that have guns and such, but there's certain things that only the police and the military should have. AK-47 shouldn't be a gun, or an M16 shouldn't be allowed on the street.
Ski, thanks so much for your comment. That's all the time we have. I'm sorry about the calls that we couldn't get to. That's this edition of Coastline. I'd like to thank our guests, Deborah Dix Maxwell of the New Hanover County NAACP and Wilmington Deputy Police Chief Mitch Cunningham. Thanks also to our listeners and those who called and emailed to join the conversation. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Join us next week. There's a school bond on the ballot this November. Have you considered how you'll vote? That's next week, Wednesday, September 10th at 2 p.m. here on WHQR 91.3 FM. Coastline's executive producer is Cleve Callison. Our producer is Ken Campbell. Associate producer is Lindsay McGrath. Our music editor is Bob Workman. The views and opinions expressed on this program are those of our listeners and our guests, and not necessarily of WHQR Public Radio or our licensee, Friends of Public Radio, Incorporated. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline.